The current sponsor of Fraudology is Sardine. If you aren't familiar with them yet, Sardine protects every customer interaction from financial crime. Banks, retailers, and fintechs use Sardine to detect fraud patterns, prevent money laundering, and stop sophisticated scams. You'll get to learn more about them throughout this quarter on Fraudology. But if you'd like to learn more about Sardine now, you can click on the link in the show notes of this episode to read more about them and to request a personalized demonstration of Sardine's suite of products. Welcome to Fraudology Podcast, where we dive into the science and study of online fraud from the perspective of an e-commerce fraud fighter. I'm Carice Hendrick. This week, there were a handful of stories that caught my attention that I thought I would share with you. Some of them may, you know, impact your job. Others are just good to know about. But as always, I'll talk a bit about the story and then a little bit about why I think it has an impact. The first story I'll share is about a group of Bank of Montreal customers who plan to sue the bank for a combined $1.5 million in wire transfer fraud. It's kind of related to the story that Haley and I talked about on Tuesday. It's just more consumers that are getting frustrated with not being reimbursed for things that they feel like banks should catch and that they shouldn't be on the hook for. Kind of related to that story, too, and I'll explain why when we get there. There was a fake Facebook page for Midjourney AI, which is a legit AI company, that was promoting malware to at least 1.2 million people. Google is suing two developers in China that created fraudulent apps for pig butchering. And then I'll also talk about a story that's out about T-Mobile employees across the U.S. receiving cash offers to illegally swap SIMs. We've talked about SIM swapping many times before because it can enable a lot of fraud. But the fact that this is out there and in the news, that's why I'm naming T-Mobile. It looks like their employee directory has been accessed. And so their employees are getting text messages offering them money to swap SIMs for them. And when that happens, you just never know who's going to take them up on it. But first, I thought I'd share a little story, a conversation I had today that just got me thinking a little bit. As a chiropractor of all things, I have permanent nerve damage in my neck from a car accident several years ago. So every couple of weeks I need to get adjusted. And my chiropractor was just making small talk and asked when my next trip would be, because I think I travel more than most people in my hometown. And I mentioned that I would be speaking at a small, like a private conference for a solution provider and their customers in May. And he asked what I was going to be speaking about. And I said, you know, current fraud threats that are happening in the space of identity and, you know, identity detection. And he said, so you don't work in fraud anymore, right? Like you aren't doing the fraud fighting like on the ground anymore, right? And I was like, nope, it's been a long time since I've done that. And he said, well, then how do you know what's new? How do you stay up on it? And I thought that was a really fair question and one that I feel like I hope that I've answered in pieces throughout the podcast, but I realized, like, I don't know, maybe it's not something I talk about much. And so the answer I gave him is a little different than probably what I'll share in the podcast, but it's a combination of things, right? So because I was on the front lines for a handful of years and then worked at the trade association and helped other people and have been working closely with other companies for the last 14 years of my career, I get it, right? I've been on the front lines. I know what fraud looks like. I know what the basic tenets are of fraud prevention from a strategy perspective, as well as from a product perspective. And if I hadn't have had that practitioner experience, there's no way I'd be able to, you know, share anything or talk, you know, have any kind of authority or, you know, be able to understand what it's like to be on the ground. But then also, I think a big part of it is that for the last decade or so, I've been building trust with a lot of people who work for, you know, pretty big size companies that trust me and that share with me when they see something new or see something odd. And so I'm able to stay on top of things because I think a lot of times the weirder things are things like, I think I should tell Carice about this. It just kind of has become something that a lot of people do, and I really appreciate it. Another way I stay on top of things is by having clients in the space. I still work with, a handful of merchants at a time and work with them on various projects, whether it's, chargeback training or fraud training, training manual review teams or training, chargeback analysts or the person that's going to be in charge of chargebacks, or doing a full assessment and fraud assessment and looking and, providing the business. It's usually someone who's not in fraud who's asked for it, providing the business with a fair assessment of how their current fraud tool is doing and if they're leaving money on the table, which often they are through false positives, if there's better options out there. And sometimes that has a training component as well. So, being on the ground and helping those companies, really does help me as well. And then lastly, I think one of the ways that I stay on top of things, well, actually there's two other ways. So one is learning what I can about newer technology companies. Sardine is one of those. Knowing what's available from an anti-fraud detection perspective is really important. What's new, what's different, what can be done, because fraud is continually adapting and their technology is growing rapidly. So we need to stay competitive. And so it's important to know what's out there. And I usually ask people on the ground and say, what products have you seen lately that have been impressive to you? Or what are you POCing right now that you're impressed with? When I asked that question last year, it was a resounding, almost everyone that I asked that's on the forefront of fraud technology said Sardine. And they're the current sponsor right now. So that's, why I'm plugging them. But it's just a good example of, learning all the things that can be done and all the things that they can do to detect fraud is one way that I can stay on top of things to know, what's possible from the anti-fraud side. And then to know what's possible from the fraud side, I subscribe to a lot of Telegram channels. You used to have a Tor browser and an Onion router and get on the dark web. And I was always too nervous to do that, especially on my own device. But with it being on Telegram and Discord now, it's so much easier because you just download the app and then you ask to join public groups. And over time, you build up an alias and you can often join more groups. They'll look and see what other groups you're a part of and how long you've been a part of them. And they're like, okay, well, they've been on this group for, 4 years. So they're probably legit. I learn a lot that way. I've learned kind of the fraudster dictionary and some of their terms and have figured it out. I don't always have time to look, through it. I don't peruse it all the time like I used to, but I certainly touch base with it, especially if I have a new client that's experiencing something unique or I'm talking to a company who, most likely they've been mentioned in a group and I want to know, what's being said about them. I'll look that up for them. But then also I'll scroll through some of the main groups every once in a while just to kind of know what's new. And especially in advance of this presentation that I'm doing, I'll be looking for, new demos of fraudster bots and other things that they're using to help share that information. Because I think what's really important and the biggest piece of this is that different companies are experiencing different things at different times. And a lot of times, those of you that are practitioners are head down and you don't have time to do the research to figure out what are your competitors seeing or what is another company that might see fraud faster than you or, unique newer fraud faster than you will see them, or first, what are they seeing that you can then learn from because they're going to come to you next after they've been detected and prevented upstream. And so I think for me, it's all about the cross-pollination of information. And this podcast is one way that I do that because I think it's a great medium and a great format to be able to share what I've learned from other companies and other types of companies. I think more and more banking needs to learn from e-commerce and e-commerce needs to learn from banking. There's no longer a clear delineation between groups that just focus on one or the other. There's a lot of cross-pollination on the fraudster side where they're going from one to the other and seamlessly, or they'll, start on one and go to the other, or, with online banking the way it is and fintech in the middle there, there's a lot of similarities and a lot of similar fraud trends and patterns that can happen. And so that's, I've kind of created this weird niche for myself that certainly didn't exist before to my knowledge, but you know, I never think it's fair for me to just keep all the information that I'm given. That's not to say that I, you know, there's still things that I can't share, company names I can't share and specifics that I can't share, but I do my best to try to share as much as I can to help, you know, you all who are on the ground be able to know what's possible, both on the fraud side and on the anti-fraud side. So I don't know, that question just, I mean, it was a very innocuous question from my chiropractor, but made me think, huh, what if I've explained that before? Or have I even really given it much thought? I don't know, probably not. So I thought I'd start out today's episode by talking about that and just sharing my thoughts on the matter as far as how I think I can stay up to date. I know that trust is a currency, and I'm so, so grateful that I have it. And I try to do everything I can to keep it. And I'm grateful to those of you who, you know, will reach out and say, have you heard of this? Or this is what we're experiencing right now. It definitely helps a lot. And I try to make sure that it helps your peers and the more information sharing we can do. And I mean, as fraudology grows and the community grows and we have a formal membership group as you know, is coming. I think I originally wanted it to be done in March. That's obviously wasn't possible, but hoping by June, having a fraudology membership community for practitioners only will be something that will be a great place for you to engage with each other so that I'm not the stopgap all the time. And that's something I'm really looking forward to bringing into the universe and providing you with those opportunities, both in an online forum, but also on group calls like I do now with retailers and ticketing and travel companies and a couple of other verticals. I want to bring that to fintech and banking and others. So that's kind of more of what's to come on our end, but it won't be a replacement for the podcast. If anything, those forums and those conversations will just provide more and more topics and subject matters for the podcast to cover. And that's what I'm really looking forward to too.
Sardine helps their clients reduce fraud rates, decrease false positives, and streamline risk operations with their fully integrated suite of products. You can use Sardine for customer due diligence, fraud prevention, risk scoring, investigations, transaction monitoring, and/or case management. Their suite of products include device and behavior intelligence, identity fraud detection, account takeover and/or payment fraud prevention, issuing fraud detection, KYC and KYB, and AML compliance, all in one platform. With Sardine, banking and online companies can capture deep device intelligence and behavior biometrics for every customer touchpoint and interaction on your website or app. Stop fraudsters from hiding their true identity. Prevent fake account signups. Detect synthetic and stolen IDs. Block bot attacks, click fraud, promo code abuse, fake listings, and device obfuscation. Prevent unauthorized access to customer accounts. Stop the use of stolen credentials. You can detect social engineering schemes like romance scams, fake financial advisors, and voice cloning attacks. Prevent fraudulent online payments, account funding, and transfers. Protect users from APP fraud, that's authorized push payment fraud. Block stolen payment credentials and decline transactions likely to result in ACH returns or chargebacks. You can also detect refund and/or returns abuse. Tackle first-party fraud and stop fraudsters from gaming your policies. Stop card cloning attacks. Prevent unauthorized card-not-present and card-present transactions. And ingest risk scores in real time for authorization decisions. For KYC and KYB, perform customer due diligence, global watchlist screening, and document verification all in one platform. Support flexible onboarding flows that route users down streamlined paths or step up verifications. And for AML compliance, centralize your compliance operations in one dashboard. You can configure real-time and batch transaction monitoring rules, investigate suspicious activity, streamline your SAR or UAR filings, and automate case management. I've seen a lot of fraud tools and can safely say that that's a lot of capabilities to have all in one platform. You can take advantage of all or some of these features to either supplement or replace your current fraud tools. To learn more about Sardine's suite of products or to contact them to request a personalized demo of their platform, go to www.sardine.ai. That's www.sardine.ai.
All right, so I'm going to dive into some fraud news now, starting with the first story I shared, which is that there's 140 Bank of Montreal customers who plan to sue the bank for a combined $1.5 million in wire transfer fraud. So this is in Canada. And, you know, primarily we talk about U.S. fraud, but I know there's a lot of fraud going on in Canada as well. This story starts out talking about a woman and her husband who had planned to use the proceeds from their home sale to renovate their new house in Ontario, pay for their children's university tuition, and to go on a family vacation. But before they could, they say someone accessed their Bank of Montreal account without authorization in late 2022 and withdrew more than $63,000 through a series of transfers that the bank won't reimburse. BMO told this couple it won't compensate them because it appeared the transfers were done on their device and there were no failed login attempts to the account, and a malware scan of the computer didn't show any irregularities, according to a letter from the bank that this news outlet viewed. I don't know how the bank did a malware scan of the computer. That's something new to me, but the, you know, seeing the login from their device and seeing that there were no failed login attempts can make it look legitimate, but that doesn't mean it wasn't fraud, right? We're very aware of malware that exists that allows people to, or allows bad actors to access the infected device and actually make transfers from that device without the, you know, person knowing. Now more than 140 customers with similar experiences from across Canada formed a group with the plan of filing a class action lawsuit against the bank. Collectively, they've lost more than $1.5 million, according to the person organizing it. That lawyer organizing it said that BMO security is not protecting us against the growing sophisticated cybercrime. The spokesman for the bank says that like other banks around the world, BMO continually adapts to help customers stay ahead of cybercrime. In the digital world we live in, these scams are fast evolving and are becoming more sophisticated, targeting millions of Canadians with malicious text and phone calls. We realize how difficult it is when a customer unfortunately falls victim to these criminals, and we provide support based on the specifics of their individual cases and circumstances, he said. And then it talks a bit about wire and e-transfer fraud and how it's growing. In general, it's a significant increasing concern. And then it lists like the number of cases. In 2021 in Canada, they had 46 reported cases. And in 2023, they had 664 cases. So it's obviously growing quite a bit. In most of the cases, we are not able to recommend that the bank pay compensation to the consumer because our investigations show that the consumer has unknowingly shared or given access to their confidential information and the bank has complied with its obligations. So that's like Haley and I were talking about, right? Like it's difficult for the bank when it looks like the customer has been involved in the transaction. But, you know, to Haley's point, it's not impossible. And especially as we know that fraudsters are getting better and better at, you know, OTP bots, and they're getting better at SIM swaps, and they're getting better at, you know, one-time password spoofs and spam calls and all of that. There's got to be an education component to help consumers stay ahead of it and be aware of it. And there has to be a little bit of acknowledgement from the bank that, you know, that may not be the case. There was someone within this article who mentioned, here we go. So there's a man who lost more than $22,000 in January through a series of wire transfers, a service he says he never used in his 25 years of banking with that bank. After the first money transfer, why did they not stop it and question it instead of letting all four go through and empty the accounts? That was a good question. And then this man is 80 years old, so he said it hurts a lot and he had to get a loan from his son to make up for some of the money lost. The bank does say that they can sign up for alerts, but which can warn customers if its system suspects unusual activity. But you know, is there a lot more that can be done? Probably. But a big part of this article talks about malware, and I'm glad it does, because sometimes they don't talk about the specific reason or what's behind the fraud. And so in this case, you know, they talked to about half a dozen clients who say that their BMO checking, savings, or line of credit accounts were drained when fraudsters somehow got access and sent themselves money through e-transfers, global wire transfers, and by setting themselves up as payees for bills. So payees for online bill pay. BMO told them that they won't be reimbursed because their passwords were used correctly. And in some cases, one-time codes were sent and entered correctly, and the IP addresses matched those of the client, according to emails from the bank. When they spoke with police, the police said that they believe the customer's devices were infected by malware, which harvests digital credentials like passwords and IP addresses from a computer, tablet, or phone. They say cyber criminals often use social media to gain information about an individual, then send them a targeted phishing email based on their interests and recent activity, which, if clicked on, can infect a device. The malware, which can evade even advanced scanning programs, then bundles the stolen information into a package, which is just sold on the dark web or Telegram and Discord for between $50 to $200, depending on several variables. Cybercriminals can then mirror the victim's computer and log into accounts, whether they're using an emulator or, like I said, some of the malware is so sophisticated that they can log into the infected device. So yeah, that bank transfer is actually coming from the infected device. I do think that one of the ways that banks can get ahead of this is also through behavior biometrics and, you know, the kind of KYC that Haley talked about on Tuesday, knowing your customer. If they've never done a wire transfer before and you see large dollar wire transfers, stop and give them a call or put a hold on their account so that they have to call you and ask them why, especially if it's, you know, not, well, either way, whether it has to be reimbursed or not, whether it's your money or their money, they're expecting the bank to protect them. So I thought that this was an interesting story because it again shows, just like the lawsuit in New York, that there's not a lot of things that consumers can do, but they can, especially in North America, sue. And that's one way that this is going to gain more attention. And, you know, depending on the way that these trials go, you know, who's found liable, this could change the course of banking and how things are reimbursed. And I know that that is, you know, a topic of focus for a few different governments across the world now. And, you know, the more lawsuits that happen, the more focus there's going to be on that as well. So I thought it was really important to share and bring up. So this story is kind of related because we're talking about malware and how it infects devices and what can be done or what can happen once, you know, devices are infected with this kind of malware. And it was found that a fake Facebook page for Midjourney AI promoted malware to at least 1.2 million people. I think it was more. But this article says that hackers are using Facebook advertisements and hijacked pages, so taken over pages, or account takeover pages, to promote fake artificial intelligence services such as Midjourney, OpenAI's Sora, ChatGPT-5, and DALL-E to infect unsuspecting users with password-stealing malware. So these are all different AI-generating software, whether it's, you know, ChatGPT for words and, you know, for rewriting things, for writing summaries, for that type of thing, or, you know, Midjourney or DALL-E is really well-known for pictures and creating AI-generated photos. The malvertising, that's a new word, but malware advertising. So malvertising campaigns are created by hijacked Facebook profiles that impersonate popular AI services, pretending to offer a sneak preview of new features. Users tricked by the ads become members of fraudulent Facebook communities where the threat actors post news, AI-generated images, and other related info to make the pages look legitimate. However, the community posts often promote limited time access to upcoming and eagerly anticipated AI services, tricking the users into downloading malicious executables that infect Windows computers with information-stealing malware. Information-stealing malware focuses on stealing data from a victim's browser, including stored credentials, cookies, cryptocurrency wallet information, autocomplete data, and credit card information. I would also say banking login information, just like in the previous story, which is why I thought these two were related. The data is then sold on dark web markets or Telegram, Discord, or used by the attackers to breach the target's online accounts to promote further scams or conduct fraud. The reach of those campaigns is staggering in some cases as people's interest in AI is currently very high. The developments in the field are so rapid that it's not easy for people to keep up and discern legitimate announcements from obvious fakes. In one of the cases seen by researchers at Bitdefender, a malicious Facebook page impersonating Midjourney amassed 1.2 million followers and remained active for nearly a year before it was eventually taken down. The page wasn't created from scratch. Instead, the attackers hijacked an existing profile in June of 2023 and converted it to a fake Midjourney page. Facebook shut down the page on March 8th. 2024. So one of the reasons why they take over accounts like that is so that the account doesn't look new. So that when Facebook is looking at the account activity, it says, oh, well, this account has been open for 5 years or 10 years, so it's probably legitimate. when really it was just someone who had a username and password for an existing Facebook profile and took it over and then changed the name of the, you know, page as well as, you know, the profile pictures and all the posts and everything else. So it was to make it look more legitimate to Facebook specifically, not necessarily to people. Many posts tricked people into downloading the info stealers by promoting a non-existent desktop version of the tool. Some posts highlighted the release of V6, which isn't officially out yet. The latest version is V5. In other cases, the malicious ads promoted opportunities to create NFT art and monetize their creations. As you can view, and this is in the article, which will be linked in the show notes, as you can view the targeting parameters of Facebook ads in the Meta ad library, the researchers found the ads targeted a demographic of men aged 25 to 55 in Europe, primarily Germany, Poland, Italy, France, Belgium, Spain, the Netherlands, Romania, and Sweden. I found that interesting that that was their target for those ads. Instead of using Dropbox and Google Drive links to host the payloads, the operators of this campaign set up multiple sites that cloned the official Midjourney landing page, tricking users into downloading what they thought was the latest version of the art-generating tool via a Go file link. Instead, they got relied V4, which masquerades as a Google Translate extension for their web browser, effectively hiding the malware as it siphoned Facebook cookies and other data in the background. While this page has been since taken down, the threat actors launched a new page that is still active with over 600,000 members that is pushing a fake Midjourney site distributing malware. The campaign's success highlights the sophistication of social media-based malvertising strategies and the importance of vigilance when engaging with online advertisements. It's why I say so much. So often I say don't click on any ads in social media. If you see something in an ad that you think is worth looking at, go to your browser and look it up there. Look up that page there. That's my best advice. I also sometimes will look at the comments to see if people say that it's a scam, because oftentimes they will go back and do that. But the biggest thing is just not clicking on ads, because you never know. They can very easily take you to a cloned website and have you download executable information. And that's why they're posing as AI, you know, some of these more popular AI tools, because it's common for you to have to download an executable file when you want to use these different AI tools. So people aren't thinking about it. They're just thinking, oh, okay, I can download the latest version. Well, it's not the latest version. And this is how you get the first fraud that we are talking about with bank transfers and wire transfers looking like it's coming from your device. So, you know, more and more that you see fraud that doesn't look like fraud, it's probably, you know, one of the possibilities is that it's malware. Like I said, I don't know. It's above my pay grade, so to speak, for me to say if that's, you know, the bank's fault or the consumer's fault. But I do think that there is a definite need for education and for more vigilance on the banking side. Whether they should be responsible in the end, that's to be determined by these lawsuits as well as by any regulations that may be coming around the bend from various governments. The next story that I thought was interesting, Google is suing two developers in China that created fraudulent apps for pig butchering. I'm just going to read part of this filing. This is the, you know, actual complaint in the lawsuit. And it's similar to what Amazon did with civilly suing the people involved in refund fraud. It's a way to call attention to this. It's a way to get law enforcement to care. It's a way to put people on notice that they're being caught. So it's not something that's done all the time, but it is starting to happen more and more because there's, you know, only so much that can be done. And when these suits are filed, they're public. So this is a 34-page complaint, but I'm just going to read the summary. At all times relevant to the complaint, the defendants, I'm not going to try to say their names, but were online application developers who were engaged in an international online consumer investment fraud scheme. Through that fraud scheme, defendants and other co-conspirators, known and unknown, perpetrated a form of online fraud through which they socially engineered and targeted victims to download from, among other sources, Google Play mobile apps that purportedly offered investments in cryptocurrencies and other products. Members of the fraud scheme lured victims in with the promises of high returns, and the seemingly legit apps were designed to display purported returns on investment in individual victim accounts. Yet the gains conveyed by the apps were illusionary. or illusory. They were an illusion. I'm not going to try to say that word. And the scheme did not end there. Instead, when individual victims attempted to withdraw their balances, defendants and their confederates would double down on the scheme by requesting various fees and other payments from victims that were supposedly necessary for the victims to recover their principal investments and purported gains. Defendants have engaged in a persistent, continuous scheme to defraud consumers. Despite Google's efforts to combat the scheme to protect users on its platforms by investigating and suspending offending fraudulent apps that defendants uploaded to Google Play. As Google has suspended and taken apps offline to shield Google Play users, defendants have persisted in uploading new apps to Google Play, using varying computer network infrastructure and accounts to obfuscate their identities, and making material misrepresentations to Google in the process. Since at least approximately 2019, defendants and their co-conspirators have uploaded at least approximately 87 apps to Google Play in furtherance of the fraud scheme. Through the course of this continuing pattern of fraudulent and illegal activity, defendants' fraud scheme has caused at least approximately 100,000 individual users to download the apps from Google Play, causing financial loss to consumer victims. The fraud scheme also harms Google by threatening the integrity of its Play platform, compelling Google to spend resources investigating and remediating this misconduct in order to protect its users, and jeopardizing Google's relationship with its current and potential users. So that's the summary of the complaint. I will include a link to the full complaint if you're interested in it. We've talked about pig butchering before. I highly recommend listening to the episode with Erin West if you are not familiar with it. She came on a few months ago and it was just, she's absolutely incredible in her relentless fight against pig butchering. And it really is an international crime that's happening against, you know, Westerners, primarily in the US and Canada, but I know there are reports of it happening in Europe as well. This is a scam that just is absolutely devastating and really has caused people to lose their life savings and, you know, in hopes of being able to invest in crypto and make more money. And it's really a shame. I don't know how else to talk about it. It's just, it's really gross. I mean, even just the name of it is gross, but that's what the fraudsters named it, because it's really, to them, they're essentially, you know, fattening the pig for slaughter, is what they say. That just shows how gross this crime really is. And lastly, this is a small story, especially in comparison of the other two or three. But, you know, we've talked about SIM swaps across, you know, fraud and just how those can wreak havoc for fraud as well. I mean, one way that, you know, people could, the one-time password for those banking victims, you know, one way that that could have been entered is because possibly somebody swapped their SIM. And so when the one-time password was sent to their phone number, it was actually sent to the fraudster, and they were able to enter that into the site on behalf of the customer. Other ways is that they may, you know, send them a text scam and say this is their bank and that they're, you know, wanting to ensure that it's their account. And so they'll say, we are sending you a 6-digit code to verify that you are who you say you are. Please send it back to this text message once you receive it. People are moving fast. They're thinking about different things. They just, oh, okay, I'll do this really fast so that my bank knows it's me. And really, you're sending that one-time password to the fraudsters to enter on your behalf. But in this case, you know, they're illegally swapping SIMs. And the best way to do that is with what they call innies and hiring insiders. And we've talked about insiders a lot too, because there's been some creative ways. And actually, I really commend Amazon for going after some of their insiders in that lawsuit that I mentioned before, in the refunding fraud scheme. They went after some of their former employees as well that were recruited to help commit refund fraud on behalf of professional refunders. So in this article, it says, we've reported previously on the issue of SIM swapping, where a bad actor illegally and fraudulently obtains access to someone's phone line by swapping the SIM card on the line to one that they possess. This allows the criminal to use the line to obtain two-factor authentication codes or one-time passwords sent to the victim for the purposes of accessing online accounts. Often this results in the victim losing money, either from their bank accounts or crypto wallets. So Separately, T-Mobile has had issues with data breaches in the past, including one back in September affecting employees of a third-party retailer named Connectivity Source. Now a bad actor seems to be using employee data to contact them, offering to pay for SIM swaps. According to multiple posts on Reddit, as well as separate individuals sending us tips here at The Mobile Report, which is the news site that I'm reading, T-Mobile employees from all over the country in the U.S. are receiving texts offering them cash in exchange for swapping SIMs. The text offers the employee $300 per SIM swap and asks the worker to contact them on Telegram. The texts all come from a variety of different numbers across multiple area codes, making it more difficult to block. And then it shows some examples of it. It looks like the text that's being sent says, "I got your number from the T-Mobile employee directory. I'm looking to pay someone up to $300 per SIM swap done. If you're interested, reply and we can talk." It's also possible that the bad actor has live or current access to this data, though they consider that less likely due to the fact that some impacted people are former employees who have not worked at the company in months. So most likely they got access to a directory from a few months ago. Still, the biggest issue here is how this person or multiple people obtain the employee phone numbers. We're not sure yet which employees are impacted, but based on comments online, it seems to be at least a few third-party employees are affected. So stores that, you know, are T-Mobile outlets. And they've independently confirmed current corporate employees have also received the message. So they're just talking about, you know, the breach that it may or may not have come from. T-Mobile PR did say that we did not have a systems breach. We continue to investigate these messages that are being sent to solicit illegal activity. We understand other wireless providers have reported similar messages. So, and basically, you know, it says it's not good for customers because obviously, you know, you can be at risk, and having employees on the inside do it because it's a very common thing. I mean, the good use case for a SIM swap is when someone wants to switch phone carrier providers. And of course, those phone carrier providers should be, you know, happy to switch those lines very quickly because they want your business. And unfortunately, you know, most cell phone, or well, most employees that work for mobile carriers are incentivized to sign up new customers to their services. Well, when they're doing a SIM swap, they're signing up a new customer for their service. It's without their knowledge, but, you know, I could see a lot of lower level employees thinking, oh, I can double dip. I can get paid up to $300 from this person. And then I also get, you know, some kind of a cash bonus internally for the more accounts that I set up. So it's something to be aware of. It's something to know that these bad actors are working really hard to try to recruit innies because more companies, and I think this is actually a good sign for T-Mobile because it means that they're getting better at not facilitating SIM swaps without needing to coerce someone internally. I know that's kind of like a good news, bad news thing, but in a way it is, you know, good news because it means that it's getting harder for the fraudsters to just call up and social engineer their way into a SIM swap. They're now having to bribe insiders. But that makes it all the more challenging because those employees are supposed to be doing that. And they're supposed to be swapping SIMs when people contact them, but the activity looks the same. And so it does make it more difficult for phone providers. I do know that education and alerting employees ahead of time and saying, hey, we understand that, you know, we may be targets for this, offering some kind of bounty for employees who, you know, report this activity may be worthwhile. Having really good reporting and analytics on your employee behavior. So if, you know, the average person that works at a particular store does maybe 10, you know, legitimate SIM swaps a day, and then there's one person in the store that does 52 or 75 a day, that may be suspicious. That's, you know, another way that you can look for it. But I think it's important for all companies, whether you're a mobile carrier or not, to know that insiders are definitely being recruited. I shared this on a previous episode, but there's a well-known retailer that has a fairly well-known employee dress code for their store employees. And they have instructed their employees not to wear that uniform on public transportation in big cities, and to change, you know, at the store and not even to wear it in the parking lot, because there are people looking for people wearing those uniforms to say, hey, I'll, you know, give you X amount of money to do this for me, you know, using your employee access. So it's something that all companies are at risk for, especially the more well-known ones, especially when you've battened down the hatches everywhere else. And the only way for fraud to occur is if an employee is coerced as an insider. So I think this is just a good reminder that this is happening and something to be very aware of. Well, that's it for me this week. Those are the news stories that caught my attention. I hope you found them fascinating as well. As always, I always enjoy hearing from you, especially if you have an idea or a suggestion for a guest or a topic for these solo episodes or any news stories you think that I should be aware of. I really appreciate you listening to this podcast and supporting Fraudology, and I look forward to speaking with you more next week.